basket with a pierced coin tied to its lid by way of ornament. A brass candlestick on the table. A small painting on the wall, rich colours deep against the whitewash. Jenny went at once to the big armoire that stood at the side of the room and stood on tiptoe to bring down a large Morocco-covered box, its corners worn with age. As she put back the lid, Brianna caught the glint of metal and a small sharp flash as of sunlight on jewels. "Here it is." Jenny brought out a thick folded wad of grimy paper, much travelled and much red by the looks of it, and put it into Brianna's hand. It had been sealed. A smudge of greasy wax still clung to the end of one sheet. "They're in the colony of North Carolina, but they dinna live near any town," Jenny explained. "Jamie writes a bit in the evenings when he can, and keeps the bits all by him, till either he or Fergus takes the journey down to Cross Creek, or a traveller passes by who will carry the letter. That suits him. He doesna write easy, especially since he broke his hand that time ago." Brianna started at the casual reference, but her aunt's calm face showed no special awareness. "Sit you down, lassie." She waved a hand, giving Brianna the choice of stool or bed. "Thank you," Brianna murmured, taking the stool. So perhaps Jenny didn't know everything about Jamie and Black Jack Randall. The notion that she might know things about this unseen man that not even his beloved sister knew was, in a way, unsettling. To dismiss the thought, she hurriedly opened the letter. The scrawled words sprang out at her, black and vivid. She'd seen this writing before, its cramped, difficult letters with the big looping tails, but that had been on a document 200 years old, its ink brown and faded, its writing constrained by careful thought and formality. Here he had felt free. The writing rolled across the page in a bold, broken scrawl, the lines tilting drunkenly up at the ends. It was untidy, but readable for all that. "Fraser's Ridge, Monday, 19th of September. My dearest Jenny, all here are in good health and spirits, and trust that this letter will find all in your household likewise content. Your son sends his most affectionate regards, and begs to be remembered to his father, brothers, and sisters. He bids you tell Matthew and Henry that he sends them the enclosed object, which is the preserved skull of an animal called porpentine by reason of its prodigious spines, though it is not at all like the small hedge-creepy, which you will know by that name, being much greater in size, and dwelling in the treetops, where it feasts upon the tender shoots. Tell Matthew and Henry that I do not know why the teeth are orange. No doubt the animal finds it decorative. Also enclosed you will find a small present for yourself. The patterning is contrived by use of the quills of this same porpentine, which the Indians dye with the juices of several plants, before weaving them in the ingenious manner you see before you. Claire has been recently much interested by conversation, if the term can be used for a communication limited mostly to gesticulations and the making of faces. She insists, I note here, that she does not make faces, to which I reply that I am in better case to judge of the matter, being able to see the face in question, which she is not, in conversation with an old woman of the Indians, much esteemed in this area as a healer, who has given her many such plants. In consequence, her fingers are purple at present, which I find most decorative. Tuesday, 20th of September. I have been much occupied today in repair and strengthening of the penfold in which we keep our few cows, pigs, etc., at night, to protect them from the depredation of bears, which are plentiful. In walking to the privy this morning, I espied a great paw print in the mud, which measured quite the length of my own foot. The stock appeared nervous and disturbed, for which condition I can scarce blame them. Do not, I pray you, suffer any alarm on our account. The black bears of this country are wary of humans, and loath to approach even a single man. Also, our house is strongly built, and I have forbidden Ian to go abroad after dark, save he is well armed. In the matter of armament, our situation is much improved. Fergus has brought back from High Point both a fine rifle of the new kind and several excellent knives. Also a large boiling kettle, whose acquisition we have celebrated with a great quantity of tasty stew made with venison, wild onions from the wood, dried beans, and likewise some tomato fruits, dried from this summer. None of us died or suffered ill effects from eating of this stew, so Claire is likely right. Tomatoes are not poison. Wednesday, 21st of September. The bear has come again. I found large prints and scrapings on the new-turned ground of Claire's garden today. The beast will be fattening for its winter slumbers, and no doubt seeks to dig for grubs in the fresh earth. I have removed the sow to our pantry, since she is near farrowing. Neither Claire nor the sow is greatly pleased by this arrangement, but the animal is valuable, having cost me £3 from Mr. Quillen. Four Indians came today. They are of the kind called Tuscarora. I have met these men on several occasions and found them most amiable. The savages, having expressed their determination to hunt our particular bear, I made them a gift of some tobacco and a knife, with which they seemed pleased. They sat under the eaves of the house most of the morning, smoking and talking among themselves, but then near midday made to depart upon their hunt. I inquired whether, the bear seeming fond of our society, it would not be best for the hunters to lie hidden nearby in hopes that the animal will return here. I was informed, with the kindest condescension possible through word and sign, that the appearance of the animal's droppings indicated beyond any doubt that it had quitted the area and was bound upon some errand to the west. Being of no mind to take issue with such expert practitioners, I wished them luck and bade them a cordial farewell. I could not accompany them, having urgent labour still to perform here, but Ian and Rollo have gone with them, as they have done before. I have loaded my new rifle and left it ready to hand, lest our friends' apprehension as to the bear's intent be mistaken. Thursday, 22nd of September. I was roused from sleep last night by a hideous noise. This was a great scraping which reverberated through the wooden logs of the wall, accompanied by such thumps and loud wails that I bolted from my bed, convinced that the house was like to fall about our ears. The sow, observing the nearness of an enemy, burst through the door of the pantry, which I will say was flimsily made, and took refuge beneath our bed, squealing in a manner to deafen us. Perceiving that the bear was at hand, I seized my new rifle and ran outside. It was a moonlight night, though hazy, and I could plainly see my adversary, a great black shape, which, stretched upon its hind feet, appeared near as tall as myself, and, to my anxious eyes, roughly 3 times as wide, being at no great distance from me. I fired at it, whereupon it dropped to all fours and ran with amazing speed toward the shelter of the nearby wood, disappearing before I could make shift to shoot any more. Come daylight, I searched the ground for sign of blood and found none, so cannot say did my shot find its target. The side of the house is decorated with several long scrapes, as might be made with a sharpened adze or chisel, showing white in the wood. We have since been at some pains to persuade the sow, she is a white sow of prodigious size, a most stubborn temper, and not lacking in teeth, to quit our bed and repair to her sanctuary in the pantry. She was reluctant, but was at length persuaded by the combination of a trail of shattered corn laid before her, and myself at her rear, armed with a stout broom. Monday, 26th of September. Ian and his red companions have returned, their prey having eluded them in the wood. I showed them the scratches upon the side of the house, whereupon they became excited and talked among themselves at such a rate I could not follow their words. One man then detached a large tooth from his necklace of such items and presented it to me with great ceremony, saying that it would serve to identify me to the bear spirit and thus protect me from harm. I accepted this token with all due solemnity and was then obliged to present him with a piece of honeycomb in exchange. Thus the proprieties were observed. Claire was called to provide the honeycomb,
and with her usual eye for such matters, perceived that one of our guests was unwell, being heavy-eyed, coughing, and distracted in appearance. Claire says he is also flushed with fever, though this is not obvious to look at him. He, being too ill to continue with his companions, we have laid him on a pallet in the corn-crib. The sow has most incontinently farrowed in the pantry. There are a dozen piglets, all healthy, and of a vigorous appetite, for which God be thanked. Our own appetites bid fair to be impoverished for the present, as the sow viciously attacks anyone who opens the door of the pantry, roaring and gnashing her teeth in rage. I was given one egg to my supper, and informed that I shall get no more until I have contrived a solution to this difficulty. Saturday, 1st of October. A great surprise today. Two guests have come.
It will be a wild place. Brianna looked up, startled. Jenny nodded at the letter, her eyes fixed on Brianna. Savages and bears and porpentines and such. It's no much more than a wee court where they live, Jimmy told me. And all alone, up in the high mountains. Very wild it will be. She looked at Brianna a little anxiously. But you'll still wish to go? Brianna realized suddenly that Jenny was afraid she would not, that she would be frightened by the thought of the long journey and the savage place at the end of it. A savage place rendered suddenly real by the scrawled black words on the sheet she held, but not nearly as real as the man who had written them. "I'm going," she assured her aunt, "as soon as I can." Jenny's face relaxed. "Oh, good," she said. She held out her hand, showing Brianna a small leather pouch decorated with a panel made of porcupine quills, stained in shades of red and black, with here and there a few quills left in their natural greyish colour for contrast. "This is the present he sent me." Brianna took it, admiring the intricacy of the pattern and the softness of the pale deer's hide. "It's beautiful." "Aye, it is." Jenny turned away, busying herself with unnecessary tidying of the small ornaments that stood on the bookshelf. Brianna had just turned her attention back to the letter when Jenny spoke abruptly. "Will you stay a bit?" Brianna looked up, startled. "Stay? Only for a day or two." Jenny turned around, the light from the window halo bright behind her, shadowing her face. "I ken you'll wish to be gone," she said. "I should wish so much to talk with you for a bit, though." Brianna looked at her, puzzled, but could read nothing in the pale, even features and the slanted eyes so like her own. "Yes," she said slowly. "Of course I'll stay." A smile touched the corner of Jenny's mouth. Her hair was deep black, streaked with white like a magpie.
"That's good," she said softly.
The smile spread slowly as she looked at her niece.
"Dear Lord, you're like my brother."
Left alone, Brianna returned to the letter, rereading the beginning slowly, letting the quiet room around her fade, disappearing as Jamie Fraser came to life in her hands, his voice so vivid in her inner ear that he might have stood before her, the sun from the window glinting on his red hair.
Saturday, 1st of October. A great surprise today. Two guests have come from Cross Creek. You will recall, I think, my telling you of Lord John Grey, whom I knew in Ardsmuir. I have not said that I had seen him since, in Jamaica, where he was governor for the Crown. He is perhaps the last person one should expect to find in this remote place, so far removed from all traces of civilization, let alone those luxurious offices and trappings of pomp to which he is accustomed. Surely we were most astonished by his appearing at our door, though we at once made him welcome. It is a melancholy event that has led him here, I am sorry to say. His wife, embarked from England with her son, contracted a fever on the voyage, and died of it while on the ocean. Fearing lest the miasmas of the tropics prove as fatal to the boy as to his mother, Lord John determined that the lad must go to Virginia, where Lord John's family has substantial property, and determined to escort him there himself, seeing that the lad was greatly desolated by loss of his mother. I expressed amazement as well as gratification that they should choose to make such alteration in their journey as required to visit this distant spot, but his lordship dismisses this, saying that he would have the boy see something of the different colonies, so as to appreciate the richness and variety of this land. The lad is most desirous of encountering Red Indians, reminding me in this respect of Ian, not so long ago. He is a comely lad, tall and well-formed for his years, which I believe are near 12. He is somewhat subject still to melancholy from his mother's death, but is most pleasant in conversation and mannerly, for all he is an earl. Lord John is his stepfather, I believe, his father having been Earl of Ellesmere. His name is William.
Brianna turned the page over, expecting continuation, but the passage stopped on that abrupt note. There was a break of several days before the letter resumed on the 4th of October.
Tuesday, 4th of October. The Indian in the corn crib died early this morning, in spite of Claire's best efforts to save him. His face, body, and limbs were entirely suffused with a dreadful rash, giving him a most gruesome and mottled look. Claire thinks he suffered from the measles, and is much concerned, this being a vicious disease, plaguish and quick to spread. She would not suffer anyone to go near the body, save only herself. She says she is safe from it by means of some charm, but we did all assemble near midday, whereat I read some scripture suitable to the occasion, and we said a prayer for the repose of his soul. For I trust that even unbaptized savages may find rest in God's mercy. We are in some doubt how this poor soul's earthly remains shall be disposed. I would, in common course, send Ian to summon his friends, that they might give him such burial as is common among the Indians. Claire says we must not do this, however, for the corpse itself may spread the disease among the man's own people, a disaster which he would not choose to bring upon his friends. She advocates burying or burning the corpse ourselves, and yet I am reluctant to undertake such action, which might be easily misunderstood by the man's companions, they thinking that we sought by this means to hide some complicity in his death. I have said nothing of this concern to our guests. If danger seems imminent, I must send them away. Still, I am loath to part with their society, so isolated is our situation. For now we have laid the body in a small dry cave in the hill above the house, wherein I had thought to build a stable or storehouse. I ask your forgiveness for thus unburdening my mind at the cost of your own peace. I think all will be well in the end, but for the moment I confess to some worry. Should danger, either from Indians or disease, seem to threaten, I will send this letter at once in the care of our guests, that it may be certain of reaching you. If all is well, I will write quickly to tell you. Your most loving brother, Jimmy Fraser.
Brianna's mouth felt dry, and she swallowed, forcing saliva. There were two sheets yet to the letter. They clung together for a moment, stubbornly resisting her efforts to separate them, and then gave way.
Postscriptum, 20th of October. We are all safe, though the manner of our deliverance is most melancholy. I will tell you of it later, having no great heart for the matter at present. Ian has been sick of the measle, as has Lord John, but they are both recovered, and Claire bids me say that Ian does exceeding well. You shall have no fear for him. He writes in his own hand that you may know it is the truth. J.
On the last sheet was writing in a different hand, this one neat and carefully schooled to an even slant, though here and there a blot defaced the page, perhaps the result either of the writer's illness or a defective pen.
Dear ma'am, I have been sick, but am all right again. I had a fever with most peculiar dreams, full of odd things. There was a great wolf that came and spoke to me in the voice of a man, but Auntie Claire says that this must have been Rollo, who stayed by me all the time I was ill. He's a very good dog, and does not bite very often. The measles came out in small bumps beneath my skin, and itched like fury. I should have thought I had sat down on an anthill, or wandered into a hornet's nest. My head felt twice its usual size, and I sneezed quite ferocious. I had 3 eggs to my breakfast today, and porridge, and have walked to the privy alone twice, so I am quite well, though I thought at first the sickness had left me blind. I could see nothing but a great dazzle of light when I went outside, but Auntie said this would soon be remedied, and it was. I will write more later. Fergus is waiting to take the letter away. Your most obedient and devoted son, Ian Murray. P.S. The porpentine skull is for Henry and Matty. I hope they will like it.
Brianna sat on the stool for some time, the whitewashed wall cool at her back, smoothing the pages of the letter and staring absently at the bookcase with its neat row of cloth and leather bindings. Robinson Crusoe popped out at her, the title picked out in gold on the spine.
A savage place, Jenny had said. A dangerous place, too, where life could shift within a heartbeat from the humorous difficulty of a hog in the pantry to the instant threat of death by violence.
"And I thought this was primitive," she murmured, with a glance at the peat fire on the hearth.
"Not so primitive after all," she thought, as she followed Ian through the barnyard and out past the outbuildings. Everything was well kept and tidy. The dry stone walls and buildings all in good repair, if a little shabby. The chickens were carefully confined to their own yard, and a hovering cloud of flies behind the barn announced the presence of a discreet manure pit well away from the house. The only real difference between this farmyard and modern ones she had seen was the absence of rusting farm equipment. There was a shovel resting against the barn, and 2 or 3 battered ploughshares in a shed that they passed, but no ramshackle tractor, no tangles of wire and scattered metal scraps. The animals were healthy too, if somewhat smaller than their modern counterparts. A loud "Maa!" announced the presence of a small herd of fat sheep in a paddock on the hillside, who trotted eagerly up to the fence as they passed, woolly backs wobbling and yellow eyes agleam in anticipation.
"Spoilt bastards," Ian said,
but with a smile.
"Think anyone's come up here has come to feed you, don't you?"
"My wife's," he added, turning to Brianna.
"She gives them all the cast-off truck from the kale yard till you'd think they'd burst."
The ram, a majestic creature with great coiled horns, extended his head over the fence and emitted an imperious "baa" that was immediately echoed by his faithful flock.
"Bugger off, Hughie," said Ian with tolerant scorn. "You're no mutton yet, but the day'll come, aye?"
He waved dismissively at the ram and turned up the hill, kilts swinging. Brianna hung back a step, watching his stride in fascination. Ian wore his kilt with an air quite unlike anything she was used to. Not a costume, nor a uniform, with a conscious bearing, but more as though it were part of his body than an article of clothing. In spite of that, she knew it wasn't usual for him to wear it. Jenny's eyes had opened wide when he had come down to breakfast. Then she had bent her head, burying a smile in her cup. Young Jamie had flicked a dark brow at his father, got back a bland look, and settled to his sausage with a faint shrug and one of those small subterranean noises common to Scottish males. The plaid cloth was old. She could see the fading along the creases and the warmness at the hem, but carefully kept. It would have been hidden away after Culloden, along with the pistols and the swords, with the pipes and their pibrochs. All the symbols of pride conquered. No, not quite conquered, she thought, with a queer small tug at her heart. She remembered Roger Wakefield squatting beside her under a grey sky on the battlefield at Culloden, his face lean and dark, eyes shadowed with knowledge of the dead nearby.
"Scots have long memories," he'd said, "and they're not the most forgiving of people. There's a clan stone out there with the name of Mackenzie carved on it, and a good many of my relatives under it."
He had smiled then, but not in jest.
I don't feel quite so personal about it as some, but I haven't forgotten either.
No, not conquered. Not through 1,000 years of strife and treachery, and not now. Defeated, scattered, but still surviving. Like Ian, maimed but upright. Like her father, exiled, but still a Highlander. With an effort, she put Roger from her mind and hurried to keep up with Ian's long, limping stride. His lean face had lighted with pleasure when she had asked him to show her Lallybroch. It had been arranged that young Jamie would take her to Inverness in a week's time to see her safely aboard a ship to the colonies, and she meant to use her time here to good advantage. They walked, at a good pace despite Ian's leg, over the fields toward the small foothills that rimmed the valley to the north, rising toward the pass through the black crags. It was a beautiful place, she thought. The pale green fields of oats and barley rippled with shifting light, cloud shadows scudding through the spring sunshine, driven by the breeze that bent the stems of budding grass. One field lay in long, dark ridges, the dirt humped and bare. At the side of the field stood a large heap of rough stones, neatly stacked. "Is that a cairn?" she asked Ian, her voice lowered in respect. Cairns were the memorials of the dead, her mother had told her. Sometimes the very long dead. New rocks added to the heap by each passing visitor. He glanced at her in surprise, caught the direction of her gaze, and grinned.
Ah, no, lass. Those are the stones we turned up with a plough in the spring. Every year we take them out, and every year there come new ones. Damned if I ken where they come from, he added, shaking his head in resignation. Stone fairies come and sew them in the night, I expect.
She didn't know whether this was a joke or not. Uncertain whether to laugh, she asked a question instead. What will you plant here?
Oh, it's planted already.
Ian shaded his eyes, squinting across the long field with pride.
This is the tatty field. The new vines will be up by the end of the month.
Tatty? Oh, potatoes. She looked at the field with new interest.
Mama told me about that. Aye, it was Claire's notion, and a good one too. There's more than once the tatties have kept us from starving.
He smiled briefly, but said nothing more, and moved off, heading for the wild hills beyond the fields. It was a long walk. The day was breezy but warm, and Brianna was sweating by the time they paused at last, halfway up a rough track through the heather. The narrow path seemed to perch precariously between a steep hillside and an even steeper fall down a sheer rock face into a small splashing burn. Ian stopped, wiping his brow with his sleeve, and motioned her to a seat amid the heaps of granite boulders. From this vantage point, the valley lay below them, the farmhouse seeming small and incongruous, its fields a feeble intrusion of civilization on the surrounding wilderness of crag and heather. He brought out a stone bottle from the sack he carried, and drew the cork with his teeth.
"That'll be your mother's doing, too," he said with a grin, handing her the bottle. "That I've kept my teeth, I mean."
He passed the tip of his tongue meditatively over his front teeth, shaking his head.
"A great one for eating weeds, your mother. But who's to argue, eh? Half the men my age are eating naught but porridge now."
She was always telling me to eat up my vegetables when I was little, and brush after every meal. Brianna took the bottle from him and tilted it into her mouth. The ale was strong and bitter, but welcomely cool after the long walk.
"When you were little, eh?"
Amused, Ian cast an eye over her length.
"I've seldom seen a lass, eh, bro? I'd say your mother kent her business, aye?"
She smiled back and gave him back the bottle. "She knew enough to marry a tall man, at least," she said wryly. Ian laughed and wiped the back of his hand across his mouth. He gazed affectionately at her, brown eyes warm.
"Ah, it's fine to see you, lassie. You're very much like him, it's true. Christ, what I wouldna give to be there when Jamie sees you!"
She looked down at the ground, biting her lip. The ground was thick with bracken, and their path up the hill showed plain, where the green fronds that had overgrown the track had been crushed and knocked aside. "I don't know whether he knows or not," she blurted. "About me?" She glanced up at him. "He didn't tell you." Ian rocked back a little, frowning.
"No, that's true," he said slowly. "But I'm thinking he maybe hadn't time to say, even if he knew. He'll not have been here long, that last time he came with Claire. And then it was such a moil way all that happened."
He stopped, pursing his lips, and glanced at her.
"Your auntie's been troubled about that," he said, "thinking that you might blame her."
"Blame her for what?" She stared at him, puzzled.
"For Lyra."
The brown eyes held hers intent. A faint chill came over Brianna at the memory of those pale eyes, cold as marbles, and the woman's hateful words. She had dismissed them as simple malice, but the echoes of whoremaster and cheat lingered unpleasantly in her ear. "What did Aunt Jenny have to do with Lyra?" Ian sighed, brushing back a thick lock of brown hair that fell down across his face.
"It was her doing that Jimmy married the woman. She meant it well, mind," he said warningly. "We did think Claire was dead these many years."
His tone held a question, but Brianna merely nodded, looking down and smoothing the fabric across her knee. This was dangerous ground. Better to say nothing if she could. After a moment, Ian went on.
"It was after he'd come home from England. He was a prisoner there for some years after the Rising."
"I know." Ian's brow shot up in surprise, but he said nothing, simply shook his head.
Well, when he came back, he was different. Well, he would be, eh?"
He smiled briefly, then dropped his eyes, pleating the fabric of his kilt between his fingers.
"It was like talking to a ghost," he said quietly. "He would look at me and smile and answer, but he wasn't really there."
He took a deep breath, and she could see the lines between his brows carved deep in concentration.
After Culloden, it was different then. He was sair wounded, and he'd lost Claire."
He glanced briefly at her, but she kept still, and he went on.
"But it was a desperate time then. A great many folk died of the fighting, of sickness, or of starving. There were English soldiers in the country, burning, killing. When it's like that, you cannot even think of dying, only because the struggle to live and keep your family takes all your time."
A small smile touched Ian's lips, the rue of memory oddly lightened with a private amusement.
"Jimmy hid," he said,
with an abrupt gesture toward the hillside above them. "There. There's a wee cave behind that big gorse bush halfway up.
That's what I brought you here to show you."
She looked where he pointed, up the tangled slope of rock and heather, the hillside a riot of tiny flowers. There was no sign of a cave, but the gorse bush stood out in a blaze of yellow blossom, brilliant as a torch.
"I came up to bring him food once, when he was sick of the ague. I told him he must come down to the house with me, that Jenny was scared he'd die up here all alone. He opened one eye all bright with the fever, and his voice was so hoarse I could scarcely hear him. He said, 'Jenny needna be worried. Even though everything in the world seems set on killing him, he didna mean to make it easy for them.' Then he closed his eye and went to sleep."
Ian gave her a wry glance.
"I wasn't so sure he had that much to say about whether he was going to die or no, so I stayed with him through the night. But he was right, after all. He's very stubborn, you can."
His tone held a note of mild apology. Brianna nodded, but her throat felt too tight to speak. Instead, she stood up abruptly and headed up the hill. Ian made no protest, but stayed on his rock, watching her. It was a steep climb, and small thorny plants caught at her stockings. Near the cave she had to scramble upward on all fours to keep her balance on the steep granite slope. The cave mouth was little more than a crack in the rock,
the opening widening into a small triangle at the bottom. She knelt down and thrust her head and shoulders inside. The chill was immediate. She could feel dampness condense on her cheeks. It took a moment for her sight to adapt to the dark, but enough light trickled into the cave past her shoulders for her to see. It was perhaps 8 feet long and 6 feet wide, a dim, dirt-floored cavity with a ceiling so low that one could stand upright only near the entrance. To stay inside for any length of time would be like being entombed. She pulled her head out quickly, breathing in deep gulps of the fresh spring air. Her heart was beating heavily. 7 years! 7 years to have lived here, in cold grime and gnawing hunger. I wouldn't last 7 days, she thought.
Wouldn't you? Said another part of her mind.
And then it came again, that tiny click of recognition that she had felt when she had looked at Ellen's portrait and felt her fingers close on an invisible brush. She turned around slowly and sat down, the cave behind her. It was very quiet here on the mountainside, but quiet in the way of hills and forests, a quiet that wasn't silent at all, but composed of constant tiny sounds. There were small buzzings in the gorse bush nearby, of bees working the yellow flowers dusty with pollen. Far below was the rushing of the burn, a low note echoing the rush of the wind above, stirring leaves and rattling twigs, sighing past the jutting boulders. She sat still and listened, and thought she knew what Jamie Fraser had found here. Not loneliness, but solitude. Not suffering, but endurance. The discovery of grim kinship with the rocks and sky. And the finding here of a harsh peace that would transcend bodily discomfort, and a healing instead of the wounds of the soul. He had perhaps found the cave not a tomb, but a refuge, drawn strength from its rocks, like Antaeus thrown to earth. For this place was part of him who had been born here, as it was part of her who had never seen it before. Ian was still sitting patiently below, hands clasped about his knees, looking out over the valley. She reached up and carefully broke off a bit of the gorse bush, mindful of its spines. She laid it at the entrance of the cave, weighted it with a small stone, then stood up and made her way precariously down the hill. Ian must have heard her approach, but didn't turn around. She sat down beside him. "It's safe for you to wear that now," she said abruptly, with a nod at his kilt.
"Oh, aye," he said.
He glanced down, his fingers rubbing the soft, worn wool.
"It's been some years now since the soldiers last came. After all, what's left?"
He gestured over the valley below.
"They carried away all they could find of value. Ruined what they couldna carry. There's no much left save the land, is there? And I think they hadna much interest in that."
She could see he was disturbed in some way. His wasn't a face that hid its owner's feelings. She watched him for a moment, then said quietly,
"You're still here, you and Jenny?"
His hand stilled and lay against the plaid. His eyelids were closed, his homely, weathered face raised to the sun.
"Aye, well, that's true," he said at last.
He opened his eyes again and turned to look at her.
"And so are you. We talked a bit last night, your auntie and I. When you see Jamie, and all's well between you, then ask him, if you will, what would he have us do?"
"Do? About what?"
"About Lallybroch."
He waved, taking in the valley and the house below. He turned to her, eyes troubled.
"You maybe know, maybe not, that your father made a deed of sassin before Culloden to give over the place to young Jamie should it all come to smash and he be killed or condemned as a traitor. But that would be before you were born, before he kent that he'd have a bairn of his own."
"Yes, I did know that." She had a sudden awareness of what he was leading up to, and put her hand on his arm, startling him with the touch. "I didn't come for that, Uncle," she said softly. "Lallybroch isn't mine.
and I don't want it. All I want is to see my father and my mother."
Ian's long face relaxed, and he put his hand over hers where it lay on his arm. He didn't say anything for a moment, then squeezed her hand gently and let it go.
"Aye, well, you'll tell him nonetheless, if he wishes it."
"He won't," she interrupted firmly. Ian looked at her, a faint smile at the back of his eyes.
"You ken a lot about what he'll do for a lass that's never met him."
She smiled at him, the spring sun warm on her shoulders.
"Maybe I do."
The smile broke through to Ian's face.
"Aye, your mother will have told you, I suppose. And she did know him, for all she was a Sassenach. But then, she was always special, your mother."
"Yes." She hesitated for a moment, wanting to hear more about the topic of Lyra, but unsure how to ask. Before she could think of something, he stood, brushed down his kilt, and started down the track, forcing her to rise and follow. "What's a fetch, Uncle Ian?" she asked the back of his head. Preoccupied with the difficulties of descent, he didn't turn, but she saw him lurch slightly, wooden legs sinking into the loose earth. At the bottom of the hill, he waited for her, leaning on his stick.
"You'll be thinking of what Lyra said?" he asked.
Without waiting for her nod, he turned and began to make his way along the bottom of the hill, toward the small stream that flowed down through the rocks.
"A fetch is the sight of a person when the person himself is far away," he said. "Sometimes it will be a person that's died far from home. It's ill luck to see one, but worse luck to meet your own, for if you do, you die."
It was the absolute matter-of-factness of his tone that made a shiver run down her spine. "I hope I don't," she said. "But she said... She stumbled on the name.
"Lyra," Ian corrected. "Aye, well, it was at her wedding to Jamie that Jenny saw your mother's fetch, that's true. She kent then that it was a bad match, but it was too late to be undone."
He knelt awkwardly on his good knee, and splashed water from the burn over his face. Brianna did likewise, and gulped several handfuls of the cold, peaty-tasting water. Having no towel, she pulled her long shirt-tail from her breeks and wiped her face. She caught Ian's scandalized look at the glimpse of her bare stomach thus afforded, and dropped the shirt-tail abruptly, her cheeks flushing.
"You were going to tell me why my father married her," she said, to hide her embarrassment.
Ian's cheeks had gone a dull red, and he turned hastily away, talking to cover his confusion.
"Aye, it was as I told you. When Jimmy came from England, it was like the spark had gone out of him, and there was nothing here to kindle it again. I dinna ken what it was that happened in England, but something did, sure as I'm born."
He shrugged, the back of his neck fading to its normal sunburnt brown.
"After Culloden he was bad hurt, but there was fighting still to do of a kind, and that kept him alive. When he came home from England, there wasna anything here for him, really."
He spoke quietly, eyes cast down, watching his footing on the rocky ground.
"So Jenny made the match for him, with Lyra."
He glanced at her, eyes bright and shrewd.
"You'll maybe be old enough to know, for all you're unwed yet, what a woman can do for a man, or he for her, I suppose. To heal him, I mean. Fill his emptiness."
He touched his maimed leg absently.
"Jimmy wed Lyra from pity, I think. And if she had truly needed him, well..."
He shrugged again and smiled at her.
"It's no use to see what might have been or should be, is it? But he had left Lyra's house some time before your mother came back. You should know that."
Brianna felt a small surge of relief.
"Oh, I'm glad to know that. And my mother, when she came back..."
"He was very glad to see her,"
Ian said simply. This time the smile lighted his whole face like sunshine.
"So was I."
Chapter 35.
Bon voyage.
It reminded her uncomfortably of Boston's City Dog Pound. A large, half-dark space whose rafters rang with yelping and an atmosphere dense with animal smells. The big building on the market square in Inverness sheltered a great many enterprises, food vendors, cattle and swine brokers, assurance agents, ship chandlers, and Royal Navy recruiters. But it was the group of men, women, and children bunched in one corner that lent most force to the illusion. Here and there a man or a woman stood upright amid the group, chin out and shoulders set in a show of good health and spirit, putting themselves forward. But for the most part, the people who offered themselves for sale eyed the passers-by warily, in darting glances, whose expressions were fixed between hope and fear, much too reminiscent of the dogs in the animal shelter where her father had, now and then, taken her to adopt a pet. There were several families, too, with children clinging to their mothers or standing blank-faced beside their parents. She tried not to look at them. It was always the puppies that had broken her heart. Young Jamie was sidling slowly around the group, hat held against his chest to save it being crushed by the crowd, eyes half-closed as he considered the prospects on offer. Her Uncle Ian had gone to the shipping office to arrange her passage to America, leaving her cousin Jamie to choose a servant to accompany her on the journey. In vain she had protested that she didn't need a servant. After all, she had, so far as they knew, travelled from France to Scotland by herself in perfect safety. The men had nodded and smiled and listened with every evidence of polite attention. And here she was, obediently following young Jamie through the crowd like one of her Aunt Jenny's sheep. She was beginning to understand exactly what her mother had meant by describing the phrases as stubborn as rocks. Despite the hubbub around her and her annoyance at her male relatives, her heart gave a small excited bounce at the thought of her mother. It was only now, when she knew for sure that Claire was safe, that she could admit to herself how sorely she had missed her. And her father, that unknown Highlander who had come so suddenly and vividly to life for her as she read his letters. The minor fact of an intervening ocean seemed no more than a small inconvenience. Her cousin Jamie interrupted these rosy thoughts by taking her arm and leaning close to shout in her ear.
"Yon fellow with a cast in one eye,"
he said in a subdued bellow, indicating the gentleman in question by pointing with his chin.
"What d'ye say to him, Brianna?"
"I'd say he looks like the Boston Strangler,"
she muttered, then louder, shouting into her cousin's ear, "He looks like an ox. No!"
"He's strong, and he looks honest."
Brianna thought the gentleman in question looked too stupid to be dishonest, but refrained from saying so, merely shaking her head emphatically. Young Jamie shrugged philosophically and resumed his scrutiny of the would-be bondsman, walking around those who took his particular interest and peering at them closely in a way she might have thought exceedingly rude had a number of other potential employers not been doing likewise.
"Bridies! Hot bridies!"
A high-pitched screech cut through the rumble and racket of the hall, and Brianna turned to see an old woman elbowing her way robustly through the crowd, a steaming tray hung round her neck and a wooden spatula in hand. The heavenly scent of fresh hot dough and spiced meat cut through the other pungencies in the hall, noticeable as the old woman's calling. It had been a long time since breakfast, and Brianna dug in her pocket, feeling saliva fill her mouth. Ian had taken her purse to pay for her passage, but she had two or three loose coins. She held one up and waved it to and fro. The bridie seller spotted the flash of silver and at once altered course, tacking through the chattering mob. She hove to in front of Brianna and reached up to snatch the coin.
"Mary save us, a giantess,"
she said, showing strong yellow teeth in a grin as she tilted her head back to look up at Brianna.
"You'd best take twa, my dearie. One will never do a great lass like you."
Heads turned, and faces grinned up at her. She stood half a head higher than most of the men nearby. Mildly embarrassed by the attention, Brianna gave the nearest offender a cold look. This seemed to entertain the young man quite a lot.
He staggered back against his friend, clutching his breast and pretending to be overcome.
"My God," he said, "she looked at me.
I'm heartstruck."
"Ach, away wi' you,"
his friend scoffed, shoving him upright. "'Twas me she was looking at. Who'd look at you if they'd a choice?"
"Nothing of the sort," his friend protested stoutly. "It was me, wasn't it, darling?"
He languished, making calf's eyes at Brianna, and looking so ridiculous that she laughed, along with the crowd around her.
"And what would you be doing with her if you got her, eh? She'd make two of you. Now off with your spawn,"
the bridey seller said, casually smacking the young man across the buttocks with her wooden spatula.
"Have business if you haven't, and the young woman will starve if you dinna leave off playing the fool and let her buy her dinner, eh?" "She looks in fine flesh to me, Granny."
Brianna's admirer, ignoring both assault and admonition, ogled her shamelessly.
"And as for the rest, fetch me a ladder, Bobby. I'm no afraid of heights."
Amid gales of laughter, the young man was dragged away by his friends, making loud kissing noises over his shoulder as he moved reluctantly off. Brianna took her change in coppers and retired into a corner to eat two of the hot beef pasties, her face still warm with laughter and self-consciousness. She hadn't been so aware of her height since she'd been a gawky seventh grader, towering over all her classmates. Among her tall cousins she had felt at home, but it was true. Here she stuck out like a sore thumb, despite her having abided by Jenny's insistence and changed from her men's clothes to a dress of her cousin Janet's, hastily altered and let out in the seams. Her sense of self-consciousness wasn't helped by the fact that no underclothes went with the dress beyond a shift. No one seemed to find any lack in this state of affairs, but she was intensely conscious of the unaccustomed feeling of airiness about her nether parts, and the odd feeling of her naked thighs sliding past each other as she walked, her silk stockings gartered just above the knee. Both self-consciousness and draughts were forgotten as she bit into the first hot pastry. A bridie was a plump hot pie in a half-moon shape, filled with minced steak and suet and spiced with onion. A rush of hot, rich juice and flaky pastry filled her mouth, and she closed her eyes in bliss. The food was either terribly bad or terribly good, Claire had said, describing her adventures in the past. That's because there's no way of keeping things. Anything you eat has either been salted or preserved in lard, if it isn't half rancid, or else it's fresh off the hoof or out of the garden, in which case it can be bloody marvellous. The bridie was bloody marvellous, Brianna decided, even if it did keep dropping crumbs down the top of her bodice. She brushed at her bosom, trying to be unobtrusive, but the crowd's attention had turned. No one was looking at her now. Or almost no one. A slight, fair man in a shabby coat had materialized by her elbow, making small, nervous movements as though he wanted to pluck her sleeve, but hadn't quite got up the nerve. Not sure whether he was a beggar or another importunate suitor, she looked suspiciously down her nose at him.
"Yes?"
You are requiring a servant, ma'am."
She dropped her aloofness, realizing that he must be one of the crowd of indentures.
"Oh, well, I wouldn't say I require one exactly, but it looks as though I'm going to get one anyway."
She glanced at young Jamie, who was now interrogating a squat, beetle-browed individual with shoulders like the village blacksmith. Young Jamie's notion of the ideal servant seemed to be limited to muscle. She looked back at the small man in front of her. He wasn't much by young Jamie's standards, but by hers.
"Are you interested?" she asked.
The expression of haggard nervousness didn't leave his face, but a fugitive gleam of hope showed in his eyes.
That is not me, no. But will you think, perhaps, consider... Will you take my daughter?" he said abruptly. "Please."
"Your daughter?"
Brianna looked down at him, startled, her half-eaten bridie forgotten.
"I beg you, ma'am."
To her surprise, tears stood in the man's eyes.
"You canna think how urgently I pray you, or what gratitude I must bear you." But...
Brianna brushed crumbs from the corner of her mouth, feeling desperately awkward.
She is a strong girl in spite of her appearance, and most willing. She will be content to do any service whatever for you, ma'am, and you'll buy her contract.
But why should... Look, what's the trouble? She said,
moved past awkwardness by curiosity and pity for his obvious distress. She took him by the arm and drew him into the shelter of a corner where the racket was slightly diminished.
Now, why are you so anxious that I should hire your daughter?
She could see the muscles move in his throat as he swallowed convulsively.
There is a man. He desires her. Not as a servant. As a concubine.
The words came out in a hoarse whisper, and a flood of ugly crimson stained his face.
"Mm-hmm," said Brianna, discovering all at once the utility of this ambiguous expression.
"I see. But you needn't let your daughter go to him, surely?"
"I have no choice."
His agony was patent.
"Her contract has been bought by Mr. Ransom, the broker."
He jerked his head backward, indicating a tough-looking gentleman in a tie wig who was talking to young Jamie.
"He can dispose of it to whom he will, and he will sell her without a moment's hesitation to this...
He choked, overcome by despair.
"Here, take this."
She hastily untucked the wide kerchief from her bodice, took it off her neck, and handed it to him. It left her slightly less than modest, but this seemed like an emergency. Clearly it was, to him. He swabbed blindly at his face, then dropped the cloth and seized her free hand in both of his.
"He's a drover. He's gone to the cattle market to sell his beasts. When he has done so, he will return with the money for a contract and take her away to his house in Aberdeen." When I heard him say so to Ransom, I was thrown into the most violent despair. I prayed most urgently to the Lord for her deliverance, and then... He gulped. "I saw you, so proud and noble and kind-seeming, and it did come to me as my prayers were answered. Oh, ma'am, I pray you, do not disdain a father's plea. Take her!"
"But I'm going to America. You'd never..."
She bit her lip.
"I mean, you wouldn't see her for a very long time."
The desperate father went quite white at this. He closed his eyes and seemed to sway slightly, giving at the knees.
"The colonies," he whispered.
Then he opened his eyes once more and set his jaw.
"Better she should be gone from me forever to a wild place than to meet dishonour before my eyes."
Brianna had no idea what to say to this. She glanced helplessly over the man's head at the sea of bobbing heads.
Your daughter... Which one?
The flicker of hope in his eyes sprang into sudden flame, shocking in its intensity.
"Bless you, lady. I will fetch her to you directly."
He pressed her hand fervently, then darted away into the crowd, leaving her staring after him. After a moment, she shrugged helplessly and bent to pick up her fallen kerchief. How had this happened? And what in the name of goodness would her uncle and cousin say if she...
"This is Elizabeth," a voice announced breathlessly. "Do your duty to the lady, Lizzie."
Brianna looked down and found the decision made for her.
"Oh, dear," she murmured, seeing the neat white parting down the middle of the small head that bent in a deep curtsy before her. "A puppy."
The head bobbed upright, presenting her with a thin, starved-looking face, in which scared grey eyes occupied most of the available space.
"Your servant, mum,"
said the small, white-lipped mouth. Or at least that's what it looked like, it said. The girl spoke so softly she couldn't be heard above the surrounding racket.
"She will serve you well, ma'am. Aye, indeed she will."
The father's anxious voice was more audible. She glanced at him. There was a strong resemblance between father and daughter, both with the same flyaway fair hair, the same thin, anxious faces. They were nearly the same height, though the girl was so frail she seemed like her father's shadow.
"Ah, hello."
She smiled at the girl, trying to seem reassuring. The girl's head tilted fearfully back, looking up. She swallowed visibly and licked her lips.
How old are you, Lizzie? May I call you Lizzie?
The small head bobbed on a neck that looked like a wild mushroom stalk, long, colourless, and infinitely fragile. The girl whispered something that Brianna didn't catch. She looked at the father, who answered eagerly.